Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 1 for Autumn Semester 2015. Lecture 4, delivered on September 1, 2015. The title of this lecture is Financial Statement Analysis.
Today, Financial Statement Analysis. I'll start off with a little story, and then I'm going to ask you something. But every semester, well, spring and fall semesters, I take the finance club students someplace where they might find jobs, internships, or at least get a lot of information about what's out there in the real world. I kind of made a mistake a few years ago, and I took them to St. Louis. And of course, there was bitching and moaning. I want to go back to Chicago. That's where my womb is and all that. But, you know, let's expand, St. Louis. So we went down there, and we went to Travelers Insurance has a finance division down there. And that's what the St. Louis office is all about. And I know the manager down there, the head manager. And they did a really great show, tried to get some of the students. They were practically saying, we'll hire you if you're, but it was St. Louis. Well, I took them over to the St. Louis Fed. Now, the St. Louis Fed is considered like the education Fed. They do all this work trying to enhance literacy in finance and economics. Good place. They were very receptive to having us down there, and they gave us a good presentation while we were there. Talked about all the great opportunities to work for the Fed and all that. Didn't really swing too well, like I said, St. Louis and all that. But we were having this presentation by one of their head economists, and he was talking about, well, every one of the regions has to collect economic data on what's going on in the currently so that we can inform the Board of Governors about, through our bank president, what's happening in our district. So in the, say, the Boston district, they would go out and find out what's going on in as far as business activity, consumer activity, all that kind of stuff. San Francisco would, St. Louis does too. And so he was explaining, well, one of the things that we'll do is we will call in the major businesses and talk to them about what their plans are for the coming quarter, the coming year, what their perspective is on how the economy is doing, how business is going to go. And we use this data to crunch some of our recommendations for the Board of Governors to consider and the FOMC and all that kind of stuff. And talking about, well, you know, we just had a meeting a couple weeks ago. We brought in Walmart, executives of Walmart in the St. Louis area, and other big businesses. He named like five, I think. So we had a long meeting, get all the data, find out what their sentiment is about how the economy is going, what their plans are. And he went on for a little while, and then he said, are there any questions? And usually you don't get many questions from the students. They're kind of trying to hope that it's over with so they don't get called out or something. I asked him this. I said, you were talking about you bring in these large companies, major employers, major manufacturers in this area, and you ask them about the economic situation, how the economy is going in their perspective, what their plans are. I said, do you do that with people? Do you ever bring in, when do you bring in, you know, normal, everyday people, workers, you know, people who work at Starbucks, people who work at the colleges, people who work at the factories. When do you do that? And the poor guy, he just looked at me like, why would I do that? He just kind of, it was just outside of the scope of what he would consider. Why would we ask people what their plans are? Why would we ask them what their perspective is on the economy? it just was so far outside of his scope that I backed off and I realized, you don't have any idea why I'm asking this. Why the Fed should consider what people think as well as what businesses think. And the rest of the tour was very good. It was a really nice experience for everybody. So with that in mind, I'm going to ask you a question to start this off. And give me an honest answer. Woman, how much are you worth? What is your current value? You don't know. Well, haven't you seen all those Facebook posts? You are special. You are God's chosen. You are the center of the universe. The sun rises and sets in your nostrils. You don't know. Well, let's try. Madam, how much are you worth? What's your current value? You don't know. Well, that's kind of scary. You got it? You got an opinion? Say that. No, you are not. What are you worth? What's your current value? You don't know. You're in a finance class, you're a business major, and you see, there are all these assets out there. Now, you go in the morning and you look at your asset, right? You see it, but you have no idea the value of it. You. Yeah.
I'm probably in the negative.
Negative net present value project and all that. Never mind that. No, let's talk about just what your value is. And I do appreciate talking about the debt side of it, the cash outflow. But, give me the cash inflow. What would it be priced at right now?
Oh, I don't have that income right now.
Okay. We are going to go to an auction. Sotheby's. We have on the auction table this fine young gentleman. He would serve as many things in your household. We have information that he could provide service as a housemaid, as a financial advisor, indeed, as a boy toy. What is my opening bid? Call it. What's the opening bid on this fine piece of craftsmanship? I know. Well, that's okay, Hell, we've been doing it to other people. Now we've got to do it. A few Caucasians get mixed into this bad thing. But do you understand it? That there is an importance of understanding value. What are you worth now? Okay, let's try it. Let's start it. What would be your expectation for your starting salary? You finish here, and you go out there, and you get your first job. $50,000? Okay. And you would hope that that would rise over the years, and you would go up, and you'll work until, well, you poor sons of bitches are probably going to work until you're 80. But let's say that you would have about a 50-year cash flow profile. Now, obviously, that concept of time value of money is going to make the cash coming in out there worth less than here, but we can still telescope that back to a value now. Say you started about 50, you end at maybe $200,000 a year over the scope of, let's say, 50 years. So, just as a stab in the dark, say that the average that I could bring back would be about, 100 grand. Over a 50-year lifespan, that would mean if I were, and I'm sure the present value, if I did it by what you'll learn, the calculator technique, I'm sure it wouldn't be exactly this, but I'm taking a stab at about $5 million. Something 100 grand on average over a lifetime of 50 years of work, maybe. Yeah, about 5 million. That would be at least a stab at what your value would be. 5 million. 2 million. I know. Now, some of you would probably be worth more. If you're majoring in accounting, well, of course you'll have a job, at least for a while. But there's also a lot of uncertainty about that, too. For example, you will read in some of the back literature that accounting is having a real huge surge, but it's also probably going to be obsolete with artificial intelligence systems within about 15 years. So you could have a real major upswing at first and then just a plummet later on. And that has happened. Software engineers were like that too. Manufacturing used to pay and still does pay extraordinarily good wages. But with the advent of 3D printers, that will probably just almost vanish as a profession, and the people who specialize in that are probably going to be basically working at McDonald's and things like that. So there's a great deal of uncertainty, especially in your time, as technologies are just surging so fast. It's just ridiculous. Even I, as a professor, within 10 years, I'll be gone, obsolete, because it will all be virtual artificial intelligence learning systems. There will be still some around, but it won't be anything like this now. So anyway, the point I'm making is that we can put sort of like a current value on you. What's the present value of your future expected cash flows? Now, to give you a little background on this, for example, for quite a long time, a soldier in the army, if he were killed, his life insurance would pay, I think it was $6 million. That was essentially what he would have earned, the present value of what he would have earned over the remainder of his life had he not been killed in service to the country. Interestingly, I think it was last year or early this year, they dropped that to a $4 million payout death benefit. Well, which is kind of an interesting thing that they did that. Part of that's budget cuts, but part of it was just actuarially, you're going to get it come out of there. I came out with skill sets, sure, but there just didn't seem to be much in the way of employment opportunities for someone who could point a cannon and kill people. Now, I don't know. I thought it was a pretty cool skill set, but no one wanted it. Now, I'm going to show you something here. I try as much as I can to connect what I teach to the actual world out there. And this is the actual world of finance out there. And the book gives you, this is where we take accounting statements and we peel them apart. We divide one number by another and say, well, what does this tell us? But always remember that whenever you're looking at financial statements, you're looking at accounting statements which show a world, the truth is not there. Little bits and pieces are there, but there's so much requirement that they follow rules and paper trails that so much of the expense and even so much of the opportunity is not captured in the financial statements. I'm going to show you something here. First of all, let me go to... there we go. That's the one I wanted. I feel kind of dirty going to Yahoo Finance, but I'm going to start with term, market cap, market capitalization. Now, the market cap is the price per share times the number of shares outstanding of the company. It is probably the best real-world valuation measure of a corporation. It is unquestionably, you could argue that the value is something else. But when you have millions and millions of traders, billions of shares of stock, buying and selling, the ebb and flow of all of those forces, of the best minds, the fastest analytical computers on Earth, you're going to have to really work hard to say anything, well, I think this is an undervalued stock, or I think that price is wrong. Well, good for you. The rest of the entire planet of finance and economics people think it's right. That's market equilibrium. Whether or not it is right in some universal sense is irrelevant. This is what the market's saying, that today, this is the value of the company. So again, market capitalization is price per share times the number of shares outstanding. So let's look at Apple. And I'm going to show you some numbers. And as you know, as I've told you before, I like to show you things, and here it is, and then later go through it a little more formally, and that kind of makes it a lot easier for you to get it on the second round if you already kind of know the concept anyway. So I'm going to swing here. Apple, at $110.65 a share, the number of shares outstanding times that gives you a market cap of 630 billion dollars. One corporation, one legal person. Under the law, Apple is a person. The Supreme Court has even said that this person deserves the right of free speech. This is a person, recognized with constitutional rights and all of that kind of stuff. This person is worth 630 or so billion. Notice how that number is changing. It doesn't stay the same. It's almost like an impressionist painting. There is not a, you can do a snapshot, but that snapshot is gone in the blink of an eye. It's kind of a cool thing, realizing that this is an organic, this is a living thing. You're seeing this thing breathe and grow and shrink, just watching it. That's a really creepy concept when you get too close to it. But $630 billion. Now, we're going back to you. You were the first one. Woman, what is the value of you compared to that market cap there? I would say somewhere between diddly and squat. Let's say diddly squat. Irrelevant. Meaningless. I hate to do that to you. You're looking hurt. But you understand why that Fed guy down at the Federal Reserve in St. Louis just looked at me like, why are you asking me something stupid like that? He knows we're not worth anything. Individually, the collective of all of you in this room, the collective of all of the students and professors and staff here at this university, we are nothing compared to this behemoth of a person. God help me for saying it like that, but that's what our Supreme Court says. That's how the law works. That person there is worth $630 billion. That one person. So let's go on here. Well, okay, maybe there's just one giant on earth. Oops. Google, $605.71 a share, for a market cap of $415 billion. So you take the two big persons under the law, and you have a combined market cap, a combined value of those two entities of over $1 trillion. Over $1 trillion. It brings up a lot of things that are not financial, questions of politics, political. How can we possibly have meaning in a world where these things have the full constitutional right to contribute to campaigns, to decide the fate of nations? Let's go for another one here. Oh, Microsoft, MSFT. No, it's just a paltry $338 billion. Oh, here's one that's funny. I like this one. I can never really remember. Berkshire Hathaway, A. Is it A? Oh, there we go. There's the price of one of their shares right there. See it? There's the price of one of their shares. Now, so if you're thinking about throwing some money into the stock market, there you go. Might have to look into the seat of your car for a little extra change for one of those shares. Look at that son of a dog. Almost $200,000 just for one share. One of the terms that we use in finance, in trading, and in brokerage is the term round lot. When you order stock, you normally will order it in lots of 100, multiples of 100. 100 is called a round lot. If you buy an odd lot, that's actually, you probably would pay a little more, at least back in the day, I don't know how it is now, but normally you would buy in round lots. So if you buy a round lot of that, well, that's going to cost you about $20 million. And then if you called in and gave this order, the broker would probably give you a discount on his commission once it got up off the floor. But there you go. There's a very expensive stock. Keep that one in mind. Throw it into your portfolio as time goes on. Now, they go in, there are others. Some of them you would recognize names. Some of them you would not. Bank of America. Oh, that's a little player. Bank of America is only $164 billion. Try another one. There's some reason that sucked. What's happened? Really? Seriously? Oh, it's just spinning around. Apparently, what did I get there? Bank of America. Yeah, it's just kind of spinning around there. How do I stop this thing from spinning? Hey, what is the X?
On the right of the blue line.
Oh. I do not use Firefox. Firefox has a very interesting little history of how it came about. And so being a good conspiracy theorist, what the heck? You know, really? Did the market crash today or something? Let me back up to one that's acting like it understands what I'm asking for. Oh, well. Looks like I'm going to be stuck with these spinners. Let me show you something. Let me show you a couple of quick things. Now, this is all about numbers. And numbers, there was a time when I was talking with some people, accounting people, and they were just explaining, well, finance is really not that necessary because we can do everything finance people do. You know, we learn how to do ratios and all that kind of stuff. And therein lies the actual difference, though. Numbers are just a waypoint for us. We do the numbers, try to find some accounting person to do them for us. But what we do is then we say, what are these numbers telling us? And what are the numbers not telling us? And that's something that I'm going to strongly encourage out of you cats in this class, is to think past numbers and ask yourself questions. Well, yeah, these numbers say this. What else do I need to know to make an informed judgment about investments, about mergers and acquisitions, if I'm doing that kind of stuff, about competitive configurations? Okay, a couple of things. First of all, I'm going to show you one that'll actually be in a subsequent chapter, but this is a great place to show it. See this number right here? That's beta. Beta is a measure of risk. It's old school. I mean, beta's been around for half a century. Well, actually, more than that, maybe. Beta measures. Okay, think about if you had a portfolio of all of the stocks of all of the companies in the economy, and the weight of each company's stock in your portfolio reflected its contribution to the overall weight of the economy. So in other words, a Google would probably have a weight of maybe about 4 or 5% because it's that large. But then some little tiny corporation, you probably have a tiny amount. This is kind of a theoretical portfolio. It's a place where we can start. Now, you can actually create something that's very close to the market portfolio. You need only about 30 stocks before you're getting pretty close to something that's smoothed out. The ups and downs of each one have smoothed out. Beta says, all right, this stock right here, relative to the market portfolio, has, in this case, 1.13 times the risk of the market portfolio. Now, it's a little more than that. That doesn't mean that if you buy this stock, you're swinging 1.3 times the market. You'd have to have this stock in a well-diversified portfolio. Otherwise, you've got all this nasty risk that you can get rid of that's also riding along. So buying individual stocks is a real bad idea because you've got a lot of extra risk in there that you don't need. Beta measures, without that extra risk, what is this stock relative to the market portfolio? And in this case, we see that Apple is about 1.13 times as risky as the market itself. Now, going on to a Google, Google is virtually the economy. Do you see that? It's almost exactly one on the dot, on the button. And it's so, and that's partly because it's so large that essentially it is beginning to act like the national economy itself. That was something that just scared the hell out of our ancestors. Even the old school 18th century economists like Adam Smith and after him Ricardo, they were all kinds of, no, all free markets. But when they started talking about monopolies, they got all kinds of warning, don't let that happen. We've passed laws early in the 20th century and late in the 19th century trying to stop the growth of monopolies. Now we just don't even worry about it. We don't even try anymore. And so there, here we go. We've got an animal out there that's basically almost the economy itself in terms of its portfolio behavior. That's kind of creepy in itself when you think about it. But let me try one, NFLX. Netflix. It's a little bit, you see, it's about 90% of the swing of the economy. So if the economy were swinging, you know, like 100 points, on average, if Netflix were in a good portfolio, a well-diversified portfolio, its contribution to the swing of the portfolio would be only about 90 points. That's one way of, that's probably a little bit off there. But NFLX, notice market cap, that's a pretty small company, $45 billion. Whatever. Okay, now try a couple of others. Let's talk about JCPenney. Riskier, small market cap. JCPenney was one of those old-time retailers that never got the clue that they had to do modern things. And they nearly died in the process. See their earnings per share? That's net income divided by earnings. Net income divided by number of shares outstanding. I'm sorry. In other words, how much of each bottom line dollar did the company get to keep? Do the shareholders get to keep? Well, in this case, it's negative. So that's kind of a sad. But notice that the price is not zero. The market is assessing that this company still has a high some probability, at least, of coming back from the dead. Otherwise, the market would just walk away and say FTS. Fancy that scenario. But it's holding on. Now, this is no doubt. This is going to be a risky stock. See that beta right there? Okay, now, just going on, and after this class, you can just go and sit at a computer looking at one of these stock screens, and when people walk by, you can tell them, you know, show them how much you know about this kind of stuff. Sears. What? that's the, on the level of risk. This place in Texas we went to, it was called Earl's Mexican House of Pain or something like that. Look at that. Okay, here's a rule. Anything above 2 is yeehaw. This is... This one is real risky. But notice that the price is still up there. But notice something else. The prices of each of these stocks, JCPenney was $9 or something. Sears is $26. But those are kind of misleading. When you look at the market cap, you get more of an idea of what total value of the company is than just with the price per share. Do you see that? These two companies had very different stock prices. But when you look at it in terms of the total value, one company could have a whole lot of shares at a low price. The other company could have a high price, but only a few shares. In this case, Sears and JCPenney are in about the same valuation configuration. It's just that if you were wanting to roll the dice on a company that's trying to come back from the dead, and you were not very risk-averse, you'd probably go with JCPenney. If you were a risk-taker, you would probably go with something like a Sears, if you were into the retail sector stocks. Now, here's the next thing. Oh, madam, what kind of a beta woman are you? In terms of what betas would make you swoon? This is important for you, stud boy. You got to know. One? What do you say? What would be the what kind of beta guy are you?
Between 1 and 2.
Oh, don't give me that range, you know. You know, give me a certainty about what kind of investment range you would be looking at. Below 1? Above 1? You're saying above 1. How far above 1? In other words, do you remember Clint Eastwood back when he was Dirty Harry?
Yeah.
He said, "Do you feel lucky, punk?" Feel pretty lucky. Okay. What would you say your beta is?
1.2.
What would you say on beta? 1.2. You know, you are actually going to be forming portfolios, 401k plans, your own investment plans. It's going to happen within a few years. Yes, you will have to be planning for your future. Right now, today is everything. But someday, you're going to have someone who is going to love you to death, who's going to follow you everywhere, and she's going to call you daddy. So you've got to prepare for that time when she says, "Daddy, I need $250,000 for my first year at ISU." And you're going to say, "But no." Okay, they're student loans. "But Dad, those have 500% interest." "Well, they didn't in my day." Okay, what kind of beta are you? Beside, what would you say yours is? What's your beta? 1.1? Copycat. Curious, what would you call for beta? Okay. Now, interestingly enough, and this is actually kind of refreshing, my other big class, they were really giving low betas, 0.4, 0.6, 0.8. The deal is that when you're young, We know that young people like to think that they're a lot riskier than they really are. That's marketing. We play to your sentiments. We sell to your needs. So we know that young people aren't the extreme risk takers. Although, have any of you ever had a friend who was just a crazy mofo? Okay, they are out there, but most of us aren't nearly as risk-taking as we want to imagine we are. Unless it's at a party and someone says, "Try this," and we're too stupid not to. And then we see people with sheep's head for the next 2 days. But the deal is this. In your young life, you're probably going to have more willingness to take risk because you can recover. If you have taken a real bath on your portfolio of investments, you have time to recover. So that would tend to mean that you'll come back, and so you're probably going to be a little bit more of a risk taker in your young years. And that's what you guys were calling. You were calling betas above one. I mean, almost every one of you. Some of them, but you were also not going crazy. "I'm a 3.5 kind of beta guy." No, I didn't get any machismo like that. So you were actually being pretty honest about what your profile of risk is. However, as you get older, You aren't going to want that kind of risk profile. Because when you get to about 30 and you suddenly have kids and you're trying to manage for their future and your future, for that second home and all that kind of stuff, and then for your retirement, you begin to pull back on your beta. You pull back on your risk preference profile and start looking into portfolios that you form that have a weighted average beta in the portfolio of maybe 1, then maybe 0.9. By the time you're in your older years, you're probably going to be wanting to have profiles that are, I don't know, I recommend people over the age of 65, 70, no more than 0.5, 0.7 on that, just as a weighted average beta of the portfolio. Just because they can't afford to have their investments crash. You can. And there's another rule here, too. As I'm bringing up, I'm trying to shape you that this is actually meaningful and useful to your lives. There's another rule that's going on here, too, about all of this, is that you hear on the financial news networks and all of this, these recommendations, buy this stock, go for that stock. Or I would recommend that you sell out. The deal is this. Even when the market crashes, it will recover. The people in the 2008 meltdown who bailed have never actually really recovered from the collapse. The people who just sat back and just did some minor tweaking and moving maybe a little, moving the beta back, backing off beta, but kept themselves in the market. They are ahead unbelievably now. It's just like that. The market's going to swing. Don't dirty your diaper. If it goes down, it's going to come back up. Unless it is the zombie apocalypse, then you know, you might want to back off if there are very strange people hanging outside your door, beating on it, asking for brains. But short of that, just don't lose your cool. You know, you can back off and realign the portfolio backwards toward the lower beta, and that's why you buy mutual funds. Mutual funds, you will see, they show you the beta. We invest in the diversified portfolio. You just choose which one of our mutual funds you like, technology, international, retail stocks, and then they diversify it with a whole bunch of holdings, and then you take the mutual fund. So in a case like that, you might have, in a good time, you might be leaning 70% stock, some kind of 70% stock mutual fund with a beta of 1.5, and then 30% bonds with a beta, and bonds are always safer because they pay off first before shareholders get a dime. Bonds in your portfolio, you might be pulling those back to maybe, into the beta of 0.6 range, something like that. So the weighted average of your beta is still above 1, but you're kind of peeling back if it looks like it's a bad time, moving forward and weighting more toward the stocks, which are generally going to be riskier anyway, in the good times. Anyway, taking that off the table. A couple of other things, let me find one. Dividends. Notice that Sears isn't going to pay a dividend. They're not stupid. They don't have any money to give to their stockholders right now. If they make a dime, they're going to plow it back into the company. That by itself is going to create more risk because they are betting that they can make that money pay off more than you can. So they're not going to have a beta. Let's look at Apple again. Apple makes no dividend. It's still plowing everything it's got back into the company. And of course, I've told you about that. If you're the kind of investor who wants a fixed, something, a check, you're not going to buy an Apple. You're not going to get any, did I? No, I was going to say, what the hell was that? Apple Pete? AAPL, I should have known. Okay, yeah, there. Oh, good. I was worried. See, that's an older company. Now, here's an interesting thing. They pay a nice 2.08% dividend. Now, the dividend yield is essentially it's the dividend divided by the current price. So, in other words, it's sort of like the yield on a CD. If I pay $110.99, I get a dividend of $2.08. So, it's like an your interest rate on your purchase. The dividend yield, that's a pretty decent dividend yield. Well, let's look at Google. Google, no dividend. Google, no dividend. They are still plowing every penny. Now, remember that money at the bottom line belongs to the shareholders, but it is the discretion of the management with the advice and consent of the directors to say whether that money should all be plowed back into the company or some of it should go to the shareholders. And in Google's case, interestingly, Google's beta is still very stable. So this is sort of saying, well, this is a company that's very much like the market, and it doesn't really pay anything. You just ride that stock up and down with the market. That's all you're doing with this one. Now, what was I going to do? NFLX. No dividend. Relatively low beta. I mean, this is a relatively safe company to invest in. I mean, it's a good company in a portfolio. And interestingly enough, these companies like Google, Netflix, Apple, they are swimming. I mean, absolutely swimming in cash. And I'm going to show you that next. But interestingly enough, in the case of Netflix, Netflix has so much cash that it won't go to McDonald's and buy a burger. It'll go to McDonald's and buy McDonald's International. But they just did a bond issue. I can't remember. I think it was like $3 billion. They borrowed $3 billion. They issued bonds, which means they borrowed. And it was long-term, and I think it was notes and long-term. Why in the world, if you are swimming in cash, would you borrow money? Any idea why you would do that? Madam? Yeah.
Well, maybe because
they got plenty. They could buy almost anything they want. Any considered judgment on this? Why they would borrow a pile of money? Now, are you going to ever in your life borrow $3 billion?
Hopefully not.
I mean, you know, the interest, the payments alone would make it hard to buy other things, but... Well, couldn't they do that with their cash, too? Okay, I'm glad. I thought I had already told you this, but now I'm beginning to realize I haven't in either class. It's the term OPM. O-P-M. Now, it sounds flippant at first when I tell you what OPM means, but I am dead serious. It doesn't take... I could give you a mathematical demonstration of why OPM is so important, but I can make it easier than that and just explain it in words. But OPM, do you know what OPM stands for? You got any idea? Not a clue? It's other people's money. Other people's money. You see, if I take on shareholders, they get a piece of every action dollar I achieve on the upside. But if I borrow money, I pay the interest, I pay the principal, they get nothing of the upside swing. So I can leverage, as we call it, my equity position by piling in debt, which is risky because if I go down, I mean I'm dead. If I can't pay the interest payment. But if I'm on the upside, you, as a shareholder, you're going to want some of my action. But you, as a bondholder, all I have to do is give you my 8% that I agreed to. You understand the trick? So with the gains to leverage, I'm creating more risk in my company because, if you know, revenues fall down, then the bondholders are going to come in and take my company away. But if I'm on a roll upward, that's why this whole thing about creative financing for houses. People will borrow a whole pile of money, then flip a house in a year. All they have, when the price of the house goes up, all they have to do is pay back the interest and the principal on the debt, and they get to keep all of the extra that was there in the upside swing. But if they've thrown all their own money into it, it doesn't work as well. Okay, so now, that other people's money principle is probably motivating a Netflix, because what they're doing is they're seeking to leverage themselves upward. Rumors are all over the place. Why would they be borrowing money? They got tons of money. Possibly some kind of a takeover move. That's where we begin to ask the real questions in finance. Why would they be doing this? They're doing good. They're swimming in cash. They got tons of movies. I've seen every one of them. I can't find anything else to watch. Kind of hard to say. Now, let's move on. Here's where this all comes to a head. SEC.gov. Now, you can go to a lot of places to get the financial statements of a company. Most of them are pulling them from the SEC's database called EDGAR. I was one of the very first EDGAR filing agents back in the 80s. EDGAR, the SEC, was trying to get corporations to file their required reports electronically. You had to do all these complicated tags and all this. It was a real nightmare. But some of us computer geeks figured, well, we could make some money off this. And you could for corporations that wanted to try to go to the electronic filing system. Now it's all electronic. It's a lot. I mean, the big dogs have taken over at being EDGAR filing agents. So there's no place for people like me in it anymore. But you go to the SEC.gov, go to EDGAR search tools. Company or fund name. Now, I'm going to just, fast would be just NFLX. Look at that Netflix for just a second. Now, here's the deal. You're going to have, these are the electronic filings. All public companies are required to make their filings in a timely manner. When you do an IPO, it's the filing from hell. But after you become a public company, you're required. You are required to file quarterly reports called 10-Qs, and then an annual report, which is the compilation of the Qs, called the 10-K. And therein is the authoritative financial information. Audited, now under Sarbanes-Oxley, the officers have to sign off on it, put their own butts on the line, the whole nine yards. But there are other things, too. Like, for example, 8-Ks are reports of non-recurring events. So you're the president of a corporation. You die. I file an 8K. He died. It's a non-recurring event. You're not going to die more than once. Okay, so, or one of the ways that I made money as a consultant back in the day, because I had this EDGAR filing stuff, I could do it like a boss. I worked for companies that were just, a lot of them were nothing but scams. And they would play these pump and dump schemes. See, the insiders can sell their stocks at certain times. They can't sell them if they're about to release financial statements on it. But they can sell their stock, some of their stock, in windows under what's called Rule 144. Well, what these officers of these companies would do is they'd say, we're going to do a press release, say something really great about our company. And then that'll make the price go up, and then we can sell some of our stock and have some money for fun. It was called, and of course, after they sold their stock, all that extra supply of stock would make the price just go right back down. It was called pump and dump, and the pump and dump scheme. But every time they put out a press release, they have to file an 8K. So I would charge $50 for 8K, and when I had like maybe five clients, they were putting out a couple every month, so it was like a steady stream of income. Yeah, go ahead, put out another report about something you're not going to do that you're pretending you're going to do, or some great new deal that you've got in the works that's not actually going to go anywhere. But yeah, that's the 8Ks. And then you got some others. These are reports of insider selling of stock. Like I said, the insiders can sell some of their stock. That's their right. But they have to do it in certain under rules, and they have to disclose what they've done. But anyway, here's what we look for is the 10K, if it's at least kind of current. Now, Now, the Netflix's is a little old. They filed, it really weirds me out because it looks like they filed the 2015 fiscal year. Now, that can't be right, but it is. They got a fiscal year, 2015, that ends that soon. But anyway, never mind. Okay, you can look at the original document. It's right there. But this interactive financial data, and believe me, it's not just for this class. You're going to have these classes here where professors say, well, find out this financial information, and that finance. Even if you're not in finance, there's a marketing professor who wants people to research and find some financial information. This is the place. Because once you go in there, financial statements, there they are. Statements, consolidated statement of operations. That's a fancy way of saying income statements. Consolidated statements of statement, where the hell is balance sheets? There's your balance sheets. Statements of cash flow. Here's the cool part. News for you. Look at this. Watch. All of their financial statements ready to go for you to use for making pretty graphs, for doing ratio analysis. They have to do it. Look, the whole nine yards, everything. I mean, they got some of this stuff I would never even read, but they talk about where they sold their bonds, what kinds of operations are going on, notes to the financial statements, the composition of their debt outstanding. It's incredible, and it's all right there for you to pull down, and then you can use it whatever way you want because it's public information. You should cite the Edgar database as your source. But, I mean, look at this. It's all right there. Now, just really quick, humor me for just a minute. Really? There it is. Okay. Revenues. I've got to warn you about this. This is absolutely important. Different companies use different words for the same thing. Revenue could be called sales. Sales, it's almost always net sales now. Gross sales, they don't even report. Net sales is gross sales minus your returns and allowances. As a matter of fact, one of my former students came to me. He was in a marketing class, and the professor said, I want gross sales reported for such and such company. And he said to me, he came to me and said, I thought you told us that these financial statements showed net sales. I said, yeah. I mean, you're going to have to figure out what they did. You're going to have to back into gross sales. Because all you're going to see in that, he said, go to the Edgar database, use the financial statements to get this in. It ain't there. As it turns out, you look in the notes to the financial statement, I think it explains we take gross sales and we subtract such percent. But, I mean, it's going to be net sales. Okay, down the road. This one, cost of revenue. That is also called cost of goods sold. Don't be confused. Now, before I go anywhere else, I'm just going to take you down this so you can know the different terminology. Because it's not just in this class that you'll need to know it. There are a lot of other classes where they'll make you know this stuff. Now, there's one line that a lot of companies are not reporting these days. But it's actually something that's kind of useful to know. Is there some reason this sucks? It's called gross income. Or gross profit. It is your revenues. It is your revenues minus your cost of goods sold. Okay, and interestingly enough, back in the day, that would have always been there. But the financial statements that I'm seeing now in the Edgar database, it's almost never there. And it's an important thing. Look, cost of revenue. You have, in one way, you have two different kinds of expenses with a business. You have expenses that you can pin right on what you sell. Give you an example. I run a company. I'm a professional landscape photographer. And I sell my stuff at museum exhibitions, at arts festivals, and online, and all that kind of stuff. Okay, when I put together a piece, I sell it for $500. Now, the frame cost me $85. I have a double mat, which would run me about $25 in that area. So there's $110 right there, and I know that $110 is attached to that $500 piece. So that $110 would be cost of goods sold. But there are all these other expenses that I have too. I mean, printer inks, mailings, my internet bill, that porn channel I watch. The thing is that you see that there are all of these expenses that you can't attach to something. So what cost of goods sold does is it peels out and says, let's talk about your wholesale. That's a good way of thinking about it. It's your wholesale price. And interestingly enough, if it's a service company, there wouldn't be a cost of goods sold line because you remember you were wanting to start that service. You were going to change your name to Gunter and do Gunter's massage service. You remember that?
Yeah.
There's nothing that you pay that is directly attached to Gunter's special Swedish massage, right? So it's all diffuse. You know, there are these bottles of oil that I got from a very strange place in China. And then there are these music tapes that I play. Barry Manilow, it's really cool. Yeah. Kanye, no, that scares people away, you know, especially when it starts talking about hitting. Okay, but you understand this? That in a service, there are no cost of goods sold line. But in manufacturing, this tells me. And you see what I can do? I can take, and I'm not going to waste the time. We can do this, the calculations. We got calculators to do it. But think about this. If I divide gross income by revenue, I get a ratio called gross margin. That tells me how much of the dollar I keep on retail over wholesale. In other words, it tells me, you know, basically about my markup. And I especially what's important in financial analysis is not one number, but the numbers from year to year. Like if I saw that last year, gross income divided by revenue was, let's say, 36%, and this year, gross income over revenue was 40%, I'd say, they're paying more for their inventory. What's going on with that? That is where you begin to get real analysis. Not with looking at the numbers, not even with looking at the 1 year, but looking at the trends. And then say, all right, the trend is stable. There's no trend, it's stable. Or, okay, the trend is this way or the trend is that way. Then you have to set the numbers aside and say, why? And that's where you get out of just numbers crunching and you get into actually being a true academic, professional business, whatever. Okay, now grinding down the line, then you get all of these diffuse expenses. You also get some that aren't real expenses, like depreciation and amortization, because your companies put huge amounts of money out there, but they're allowed to only put a little bit of that on each year's expense. They have to capitalize the huge expenses and then chop it up, which kind of misleads you. But we get down here to operating income. That's how many dollars are left after all of your bills, almost all of your bills. All of your internal bills are paid. All of your operating stuff is paid. By the way, there's another term for this too, and I'll tell it to you right now. Ouch, damn it. EBIT, earnings before interest and taxes. Essentially, it's how many dollars are left for the shareholders right before the big dogs, your debt holders, and Uncle Sam come in to kick your butt. Okay? EBIT. It's kind of an important number because the number right below it, and sometimes you got to look, there are a couple of lines of interest expense. interest they pay out on their borrowings, sometimes interest that they bring in on investments, debt investments. Okay, but you put those numbers together, and you get your total interest expense. Okay, your total interest expense. In this case, it's what, about 53 grand? 53 grand off EBIT. If you divide your operating income by your interest expense, you get a term, you get something called times interest earned, TIE. It's how many times over what you have available to pay the bondholders covers what you have to pay the bondholders. Let me say that again. It's how many times over what you have to pay the bondholders their interest divided by what you have to pay those bondholders. So in other words, making the numbers less tedious than this, suppose that your operating income, your EBIT, this really sucks, this marker, is $100,000. And your interest expense is $20,000. God, this is, that's $100,000, that's $20,000. Times interest earned for this company would be 5.0 times. In other words, they can pay their interest five times over. They can pay their interest five times over. It's a useful measure. Now, back to you. Question for you. Is there some reason I have a marker here that doesn't work? I have a marker down there that works. I have a highlighter, but if I use that, building maintenance is going to come around and throw me around against walls. So anyway, okay, suppose I have two companies. Company one, its times interest earned is 25.0 times. Yeah, I can't even see that. Time 1.5 times. Okay, let me read that to you. Company one can cover its interest payments 25 times over. Company two can cover its interest payments 1.5 times over. Which is a better company? Can you tell me?
Company two.
What? Company two. 1.5? Okay. Of course, you understand that there's more risk there because, well, what happens if their revenues drop? And that might be magnified by fixed expenses. They're kind of closer. That might worry me some. But at the same time, 25%. Is that a good number? They can pay their interest payments 25 times over. Is that good? It's actually, I would be worried about this company. Because this company has so little debt, it's not taking advantage of any gains to leverage. I mean, it's got all this money. They could be actually leveraging with debt, magnify the return on equity to their shareholders. But no, we don't do that kind of stuff in our company. So there's this balance. You can't ever say what a number is. Obviously, you go below, if the times interest earned is below one, we have a name for that company. It's dog meat. It's gone. Do you remember what I told you happens if you don't pay your bondholders their interest payments? You don't remember? Do you remember? Maybe I didn't tell you. If you don't give your shareholders a dividend, all they can do is bitch at you. But if you don't pay your interest payments on your debt, they will shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. Mrs. Fox, awesome. Starter kit. You understand? Ow, I'm sorry. You understand. You have to pay your debt holders. So you want to make sure that you have enough that you can do that. And if you've got a volatile revenue and that's swinging your operating income hard, you might want to have your times interest earned pretty good above that thrashing point. But if you're so far up there that You can pay your interest payments over and over again. I'm not impressed by that. That's a company that is wasting the ability. It could get debt at an incredibly low rate. Bondholders see a company, you can pay your interest 25 times over. They'll give that company really excellent coupon rates. Why don't you take advantage of it? Because if you have upside potential, well, great. You can magnify that because you have to pay the bondholders back a fixed amount of money. And that makes it all the better for your shareholders that get all that extra gain that you're creating through the leverage. That's why that's important. Last thing here, real quick here. Then you have to pay your income taxes. And this is where you get a lot of yelling, because people who are not properly trained will look at this sometime. They'll say, well, that company didn't pay any taxes last year. That company, for example, let me back down here just real quick and show you. Let's back up here real quick. Okay. Exxon. No, let me try. Exxon. Exxon Mobil. There it is. A 10Q, a K. I got to find a K here real quick. Okay. Yeah, they're so huge. They're making filings all the time. 10-K. Financial statements. See their income taxes? Income taxes, 18 on taxable income taxes. On taxable income, fifty-one. Very low tax rate for one of the largest companies on earth. But you got to look very carefully. They might be paying taxes in other countries and using that as a shield against taxes here. You never know. We'll pick this subject up next time. That's all I have for you. I thank you.